Life doesn't pause when you're sick. Vaccines against respiratory illnesses can help protect you and give you more playtime with your best friend. Depending on age and health status, vaccinations for flu, COVID-19, RSV, or pneumococcal infection may be recommended. Vaccines can help keep you from having a rough time. Learn more at cveep.org/vaccines-protect. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and CVEEP, fighting infectious respiratory disease.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving into a case that, well, it's just baffled everyone for decades now.
It really has.
We're talking about the Springfield Three. And the story is just, it's built on a contradiction, isn't it? A crime scene that seems totally clean, yet violated at the same time.
Exactly.
Pristine and disturbed.
So picture this. It's the early morning, June 7th, 1992, Springfield, Missouri. And the puzzle for you listening is this. Three women disappear, vanish, from a house that was locked.
Seemingly safe.
Right. Seemingly safe.
Yeah.
And they leave behind everything, all their personal items, IDs, cars, everything. But there's still this one undeniable trace of violence. It just, it doesn't compute.
And that's what makes this case, you know, such a defining example. The disappearance of Cheryl Lovett, who's 47, her daughter Suzanne Streeter, 19, and Susie's friend Stacy McCall, 18. It's become almost the textbook case of vanishing from what should be a secure place.
Yeah.
Our mission here isn't just to rehash the timeline, but to really zero in on why these specific clues, the order mixed with the trauma, are so contradictory and what that might imply. Okay, so let's set that scene. The night they went missing, Stacy and Susie, they just graduated high school the day before.
Big celebration, a milestone.
Exactly. So they were out celebrating, ended up back at Cheryl Levitt's house, Susie's mom. That was the plan. Stay there.
A normal end to a big day.
Seems like it. But when friends and family couldn't reach them the next day, and the police eventually checked the house, well, that's where things get really strange. Some things suggested a totally normal departure, but other things screamed that something was deeply, deeply wrong.
And I think the first place to look is what was left behind. That inventory list?
Yeah.
It's the first major hurdle for any conventional theory.
Tell us about that. What exactly was there?
Well, like you said, everything. Their purses, their wallets, all their identification, keys for the house, and cars. And their cars themselves. All still there.
Okay, stop there for a second. Purses, ID, keys, cars. If you're running away, what do you take?
Your ID, your money, maybe your car keys? Absolutely.
Right. And if you're abducted, forced out, maybe you don't grab your purse, but the abductor takes you in a vehicle, maybe yours, maybe theirs.
Exactly. But their cars were untouched. Right there. Parked.
So if they were taken, say, quickly, forced into some other car, why would the person responsible leave behind the very things, ID, wallets that could help find them later or help them survive if they were somehow released? It makes zero sense.
It's completely counterintuitive. It just doesn't fit that profile of a, you know, quick, violent abduction where someone's forced into a car at gunpoint.
So what does it point to?
Well, it sort of pushes you towards two possibilities. Both pretty chilling. Either they were forced to leave with absolutely nothing, which implies an incredible amount of control by whoever took them, or they were taken somewhere where those items, well, they wouldn't be needed anymore.
Okay. But then there's the house itself. If they were forced out, even with that level of control, you expect something, a sign of struggle, a broken lock, something.
And that's the next layer of contradiction, the house itself. Investigators found absolutely no signs of forced entry.
No kicked in doors, no broken windows.
Nothing like that.
Yeah.
Which strongly suggests, doesn't it, that either the women knew the person who came in and let them in voluntarily.
Or they were already inside when the person arrived, maybe surprised and just subdued very quickly and quietly.
That seems to be the implication. Minimal disturbance at the entry points.
And then there's that detail about the beds. It adds this really eerie sort of domestic layer to it all.
The beds were slept in, all three. It looks like they went through their nightly routines, maybe were already asleep or getting ready to.
So you've got women at home, beds slept in, all their stuff around them. Then they vanish. No forced entry, no obvious signs of a big fight.
It just screams, doesn't it, that whatever occurred was either incredibly well-planned, highly organized, or just completely overwhelming and sudden for them.
Okay, but let's really focus now on maybe the most crucial and frankly bizarre piece of physical evidence about the house itself. The front door.
Ah, yes, the door.
Because this detail, this is what really sets the Springfield 3 apart, I think.
Absolutely.
The
mystery of the front door, it's like the linchpin holding all the weirdness together.
Rare.
Get this. When the police arrived, the house was locked. But the key.
Where was it?
It was in the lock, on the outside.
Wait, in the lock, on the outside of the locked door.
Exactly. Which is highly unusual, right? If you lock your door from the inside at night, you take the key out, you put it on a table, hang it on a hook.
Sure, it stays inside with you.
So finding it in the lock, on the outside, that implies someone locked the door from the outside as they were leaving.
Okay, now why would someone do that? If you've just potentially abducted three people, you want to get away fast, right? Why take the time to carefully lock the door behind you? That seems risky, unnecessary.
That's where the thinking shifts, doesn't it? From just abduction to something more like staging or concealment.
Yeah.
Locking the door from the outside with the key and then just leaving the key in the lock.
What does that suggest?
It suggests a deliberate act, an effort to secure the scene. Maybe make it look like the occupants had just locked up and left normally for a bit, or at least delay discovery.
So the person responsible, they prioritized control and maybe the appearance of order over a fast getaway.
That points towards premeditation, I think.
Not
some crime of opportunity, not a robbery gone wrong where you'd expect panic and speed.
Right. A home invasion that escalates, the person usually bolts. They don't pause to neatly lock up.
Precisely. Securing that door suggests the goal wasn't just removing the women. It was also about controlling the scene, preventing immediate entry, buying time before anyone realized they were gone. Critical time.
And then there's that other little detail right near the door, the broken porch light.
Yes, the globe on the porch light was found broken on the front steps.
So something happened right there at the threshold. But again, not necessarily a violent forced entry, maybe more like a scuffle during the exit or some interaction right there.
It suggests activity right at that point of entry, or more likely exit. But again, it's minor compared to what you might expect. So you have this strange mix. A carefully locked door, maybe a minor disturbance right outside it.
The slept in beds, all the IDs and cars left behind. This picture of order.
Right, all this order. And then you have to reconcile it with the one really disturbing piece of evidence found inside.
Okay, so let's transition to that. Because if the house was mostly locked, secured, orderly, what did investigators find that shattered that illusion? This is the forensic bombshell, isn't it?
It is. Amidst all that apparent order, the only undeniable sign of something violent, the only significant physical disturbance inside, was a mysterious blood stain.
Just one stain. You specified significant. What does that mean? Like not a drop, but not a huge pool either.
Sources suggest it was, let's say, noticeable, significant enough to indicate injury. But critically, it wasn't the kind of widespread blood spatter you might associate with, say, a violent struggle involving three adults or a murder scene inside the house.
Okay, that's confusing. If three people were overpowered, potentially injured or worse, inside that house, wouldn't you expect more? More blood, more disarray near the stain?
That is the absolute crux of the interpretive challenge here.
Yeah.
The blood confirms something physical happened, an injury, some kind of trauma. But its limited nature compared to three missing people is what's so baffling.
If they were all attacked violently right there, it should have been messy. Very messy.
Exactly. So the fact that we seem to have just this one area, this single significant stain, it spins off several unsettling possibilities.
Okay, walk us through those. Because this one piece of evidence, the blood, it has to somehow fit with the locked door, the left behind items, everything.
Right. Theory one, the blood belongs to one of the women. Maybe she was injured slightly during the initial confrontation or while being subdued.
Oh.
This would suggest the main violence or perhaps the killing of that occurred happened elsewhere. It supports that idea of an efficient removal from the house. Get them out quickly.
Right, minimizing the mess inside. Theory two.
The blood could belong to the perpetrator. Perhaps they got cut or injured themselves during a brief struggle. Again, that might fit with a scenario where the victims were quickly controlled and removed before major violence occurred inside the house.
Okay. Or is there a third possibility, something more manipulative?
Well, this is where it gets darker. Could that single stain have been left deliberately, planted almost?
Why? To what end?
To confuse things. A small amount of blood confirms a crime likely happened. It forces police to treat it as more than just missing persons. It points towards foul play, possibly homicide.
But at the same time, keeping the rest of the scene so tidy reinforces that weird sense of control, maybe throws investigators off the real sequence of events.
Precisely. It muddies the water. Was it meant to look like they just vanished? Or vanished after some kind of contained violent event?
Yeah.
That stain pushes it firmly into foul play territory. It means authorities are looking for bodies, even though none of the women took anything they need to start a new life.
So, putting it all together, It feels like a crime designed for maximum confusion. Extreme efficiency, leave everything behind so they can't be easily traced or start over. But also, lock the house meticulously, leave a hint of violence. It's like an architect designed a disappearance.
That's a good way to put it. The synthesis points towards someone, or maybe more than one person, who was incredibly meticulous, focused on concealment, controlling the scene, controlling the narrative from the very start.
Leaving the IDs stops them being found easily if they're alive somewhere else. Locking the door delays discovery. The blood signals, crime not, ran away.
Exactly. It potentially directs the immediate search efforts, maybe buys the perpetrator even more time. It's a chilling combination of actions.
And despite how incredibly strange this all was, the investigation wasn't small. It wasn't ignored.
Oh, absolutely not. This wasn't a case that went cold because nobody cared or tried. A massive investigation was launched almost right away, back in 92.
Generated tons of leads, right. Yeah. Public interest was huge.
Immense. Numerous leads over the years. Decades of work. Because the clues are just so inherently baffling.
But here's the bottom line, the hard fact for you listening today.
Despite everything, all the resources, the media attention, decades of police effort, Cheryl, Susie, and Stacy have never been found.
Never found, and critically.
No one has ever been charged, not a single person. The case remains open, officially unsolved.
Yeah.
A truly chilling example, as the sources say, of people vanishing without a trace from inside their own locked home.
It just loops right back to that first puzzle, doesn't it? How can a place be so secured, apparently locked from the outside by the perpetrator, while also holding evidence of normal life, abruptly stopped the beds, the cars waiting, and yet also containing that one single terrifying signature of violence?
It's the enduring, deeply frustrating question mark over the Springfield 3. And it forces you to think about what safety even means, doesn't it? If the person responsible took the risk of locking that door, leaving the key, it suggests that delaying discovery, securing that scene, was absolutely crucial to the plan's success.
Okay, so here's the final thought, something for you to really chew on. If someone is capable of getting three people out of a locked house with no forced entry, and they are so meticulous, so careful, that they lock the door behind them using the key, what does that really tell you about the level of planning or maybe surveillance involved beforehand?
It implies something far beyond an opportunistic crime.
Right. It feels calculated. So the question it leaves you with is, what kind of profound security breach does that represent in a place you think is safe, your home? And what level of anonymity, what level of skill or luck must that person still possess for all these years for that massive investigation to have resulted in zero arrests?